Members, today, Monday, Wednesday, February 26th, and the time is 1 o'clock. I call this meeting of Health, Finance, and Policy Committee to order. And members, we have a quorum. Representative Schumacher, have you had a chance to look at the minutes, and would you like to move for their approval?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move approval of the minutes from February 24th, 2025.
Representative Schumacher moves approval of the minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Oppose, say nay. The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. Okay. First on deck, members, is House File 129. Representative Rapinski, you may walk up to the table. And the chair moves House File 129 to be placed on the general register. Representative Rapinski, to your bill.
Thank you, Chair Backer, fellow reps. My intention is to have this move to the general registry, House File 129. House File 129 essentially is the legislature created the Safe Harbor Program for exported children in 2011. The program is run by the Department of Health, and it requires that the Director of Sex Trafficking Prevention submits a report to the Commissioner of Health every 2 years. Protecting children from human trafficking is important to all of us, and us policymakers should help provide that. I think we'd benefit by having this report. And House File 129 simply requires that the biennial report that the Director of Sex Trafficking Prevention provides to the Commissioner of Health must also be provided to Public Safety and Health Committees in the House and the Senate. My fellow representatives, I ask for your support on this. It is a bipartisan issue. Thank you, Chair Backer.
Yes, thank you very much. Would anyone from the public like to testify on behalf or against House File 129? Okay, seeing none, members, I will open up to questions and discussions. Okay, Representative Leaving.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks, Representative. Could you just, this is a pretty small change, but could you just tell us kind of why you're doing it, what the background of this is, what brought this to your attention, what problem you're solving here?
Representative Rapinski.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for your question. I believe I've heard you use the term a tool in a toolbox before. I believe this really gives not only the public safety group, but also the health committee, just another tool in their toolbox to make decisions on stuff. The report's already being taken care of. It's already out there. It's simply just giving us and the public safety board that report also, just having more eyes on it. That's all.
Follow up there.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I mean, certainly that's a good goal, and I'm not arguing with that, but you know, these reports are available to us even if the legislation doesn't say it has to be sent to us, right? I mean, I assume it's available. I still didn't kind of hear what, you know, I mean, it, even though it's a small change, and it's certainly I don't object to what you're trying to do here, but you know, going as far as actually writing a bill and submitting a bill and getting a hearing kind of suggests that there's a bigger reason. Is there something that you're hoping that we're going to see or that we're going to follow or that's going to happen as a result of this that has prompted you to make the effort to do this?
Representative Rapinski.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, thank you, Rep. I think it just gives us more information. As a new legislator, I like to have as much information as I can on different subjects. And since it's already out there, I don't understand why somebody would be against this at all.
A follow-up there?
All right. Well, Mr. Chair, well, as I said, I'm not against it. I'm just wondering why we're doing it, because the information, I think, maybe you can answer, isn't the information available to us, even if it doesn't actually get submitted? I mean, in my experience, being submitted to certain members just means they email a copy. Mm-hmm. But it's certainly available to anyone who wants to go and look for the information. So, yeah, it does... you know, it brings it more to people's attention, but it's certainly there already. I mean, I'm just really asking you, and I'm, as I said, I'm not opposed to it. I just really want to understand why you are making the effort to bring this particular thing to this committee.
Go ahead, Representative Rapitsky.
Thank you, Chair. I think for me personally, if it's going to be emailed to the group, to that committee, it's more readily available than having to go and search it out. And I think that's the biggest intention here.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions from members? Okay, seeing no further discussion, Representative Rapitsky, please close on your bill.
Fellow representatives, thank you very much for your time, and I appreciate your support.
The most important question, where are the treats?
Actually, Chair Backer, this is not the first time I've presented this. This actually came from our public safety division, and I understand it's my first time. But I do plan on bringing treats for you folks, but I really want to bring the best treats you've ever had. And being from Winona, Minnesota, home of Blado's Bakery, one of the top bakeries in the nation, my intention is to have my wife bring fresh baked bakery goods on one of our committee meetings for you. So that will happen within the next few weeks. It's just coordinating schedules with my wife. And then you'll truly appreciate it was definitely worth the wait.
Okay. We'll take your word on it, okay? So thank you. First of all, thank you, Representative Rapitsky. The chair renews his motion that House File 129 be placed on the general register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed say nay. The motion prevails, and House File 129 is placed on the general register. Okay. We have now House 958, so that's the next item on the agenda from Vice Chair Nadeau. Representative Nadeau, while you're coming to the table, the chair moves that House File 958 be re-referred to the Committee of Human Service Finance and Policy. Representative Nadeau, I believe you have a DE1 author amendment to get the bill in the shape you would like. I move that we adopt the DE amendment. So all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say nay. The amendment is adopted. Representative Nadeau, please present your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Thanks for scheduling this bill for today. Minnesota, as everyone knows, Minnesota struggles with mental health and substance use crisis that affects individuals across all ages and all of our communities. As of February 2021, 37% of Minnesota adults experience symptoms of anxiety or depression. 25% of women nationally are on antidepressants. 80% of Minnesota counties qualify as mental health professional shortage areas, and about a quarter of Minnesotans in need of mental health care receive effective treatment. Our current health care system is moving at hyper speed, but it has room for improvement. And the best way that I believe that we can provide help is to provide value-based, integrated, and collaborative care. House File 958 stands to make a significant impact on the way that we deliver mental health care in Minnesota, making a collaborative care model a reimbursable Medicaid benefit in our state. Collaborative care is an integrated approach to health care that focuses on treating common mental health conditions within primary care settings. It involves various health practitioners, including primary care physicians, behavioral health clinicians, and psychiatric specialists working together to treat the patient as a whole person. The goal is to improve patient outcomes, reduce costs, and empower patients and their families. I just learned this recently, but 80% of mental health care is provided in a primary care setting, and every dollar that's invested in collaborative care saves $6.50 in reduced health care costs and improved productivity. House File 958 allows specified providers to bill Medicaid using collaborative care codes, establishes a sustainable reimbursement rate, and allocates minimal one-time funding for startup and training costs. Collaborative care is not just a theoretical concept. It's a proven, evidence-based solution that's currently covered by Medicare and nearly all commercial payers, with 37 states already offering this as a Medicaid benefit. In closing, the collaborative care model represents a transformative step towards comprehensive mental care. The benefits are clear: improved healthcare outcomes, cost savings, and sustainable reimbursement rates that attract and retain providers. Passing House File 958 today helps Minnesotans access quality mental health care and at the same time uses our tax dollars more efficiently. Please read what's in your packets. You'll see a one-pager that has support from a variety of organizations who will use and benefit their patients with this model. And I have three testifiers who can share a lot more about the functionality and the collaborative care model and give examples about how it has improved their patients' outcomes, as well as answer some of the more technical questions about this approach.
Yes, testifiers. The order, we're going to take it with Mr. Jadwin, then Mr. Darnell, and then Mr. Triangle. So please state your full name, and we would ask you to limit your testimony to 3 minutes or less. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and the committee. My name is Frank Jadwin. I'm a clinical social worker by training. I work for Hennepin Healthcare. I support their integrated behavioral health efforts, currently under the collaborative care model. And I am honored to be here today to present the collaborative care model to you. It's an innovative care model with efficacy demonstrated in more than 100 randomized controlled trials to be an effective intervention across diverse diagnoses, patient populations, and treatment settings. The collaborative care model has designated billing codes that are reimbursed by Medicare, most commercial insurance, and Medicaid plans in 37 other states. Our hope is to make Minnesota the 38th state to recognize this service as a Medicaid benefit. The collaborative care model is a team-based approach that integrates behavioral health services, meaning mental health and substance use treatment, into the primary care setting. It's designed to improve the care quality and outcomes for patients experiencing behavioral health conditions by fostering close communication and coordination among healthcare providers, including the primary care provider, a behavioral health clinician, and a consulting psychiatrist. It does this with the assistance of a registry tool that also monitors a patient's progress. The collaborative care model differs significantly from traditional mental health services in its integration and accessibility. In traditional models, behavioral health services are often siloed from primary care, meaning patients must seek out separate, specialized care. This can create barriers such as long wait times, stigma, and limited access to behavioral health providers, especially in underserved areas. We know that the majority of referrals from primary care to specialty mental health and substance use treatment do not materialize, and we know that primary care providers prescribe the majority of the mental health medications. The collaborative care model embraces this reality and offers an enhancement by constructing a multidisciplinary team working together to coordinate care. The collaborative care model embeds mental health professionals within the primary care teams instead of referring patients to external specialists. Primary care providers collaborate directly with experts on their own team. This enables timely treatment, reduces stigma, and allows for coordinated care for both physical and behavioral health conditions. Research shows that this approach is about twice as effective as usual care. In the model, a patient can expect more frequent but brief interactions with their behavioral health care manager. This allows them to focus on specific treatment goals with a higher level of accountability. The behavioral health care manager also meets weekly with the psychiatrist, without the patient present, to discuss treatment plans, clarify diagnoses, and make medication recommendations when appropriate. These recommendations are then shared back to the primary care provider, who is the prescriber, supporting their practice with the time, energy, and expertise of these other professionals. The last component of the collaborative care model is the registry. This tool tracks patients and their progress, helps to inform treatment, and incorporates another proven approach, measurement-based care. It lets the care team know if what they're doing is helping the patient get back on track, but if not, it also prompts the discussion on how to make adjustments to that care plan. This model has shown significant success in improving patient outcomes, reducing healthcare costs, and increasing the overall quality of care. Its widespread implementation can lead to better management of chronic conditions, lower rates of hospitalization, and a more coordinated and comprehensive healthcare system. Thank you.
Thank you. Next is Kyle Darnell. Please state your name and about 3 minutes or so. We're trying to keep it to. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'm Dr. Kyle Darnell. I'm a psychologist by training and currently the executive director for behavioral health at CentraCare, which is a rural health care system located to the north and west of the Twin Cities Metro. I specifically wanted to thank Representative Perryman for helping us bring this bill forward. I want to highlight the existing gaps in supply and demand and how the collaborative care model will impact the future of care in greater Minnesota. I provided some handouts that illustrate the statewide psychiatric need. According to the Health Resources and Services Administration, Minnesota currently has 62% of what we need for adult psychiatrists and 63% of what we need for child and adolescent psychiatrists. By 2037, we anticipate our adult psychiatric workforce to decrease while the demand for services will increase, leaving us at 40% of what we need. Although we expect a moderate increase of child and adolescent psychiatrists, the demand will outpace, and we anticipate we will be 56% adequate by 2037. These are statewide projections. We know that our providers are not evenly distributed across the regions of our state, and that 80% of our counties are designated health provider shortage areas for mental health. My final handout is based on numbers of licensed providers by zip code and population to provider ratios. When it comes to psychiatry, three of our six regions currently have population to provider ratios that are twice as bad as the statewide total. Specifically, for the entire state, we have approximately one psychiatrist for every 8,000 patients. But in the central region, where my office is located, we have approximately one psychiatrist for every 21,000 patients, with the Northwest and Southwest regions closely following and nearly tying for second to last place. Without a successful recruitment of a shrinking workforce shortage, I anticipate CentraCare will see a 50% decrease in its current psychiatric full-time equivalencies in the next 5 to 7 years. Even though we are collaborating with the University of Minnesota to build a new medical school and to expand the psychiatric residency program, we will not be able to train enough psychiatrists to close the gap on the current or anticipated future needs. For rural healthcare, the collaborative care model isn't just about innovation, improvement, or about meeting the best contemporary standards of care. It is a necessity. It is a lifeline. It is the way we will need to deliver psychiatric care to our patients in the future. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Next on deck is Mr. Michael Trangle. Go ahead, state your name, and go ahead with your testimony. Thank you.
Okay. I'm Michael Trangle, and I feel like a semi-endangered species, but I'm a psychiatrist. Part of what I was asked to talk about, I've been an adult and adolescent psychiatrist for most of my career. Also done some administration, but more importantly, I've also worked in the collaborative care model for probably about 10 years.
Excuse me, could you pull up to the mic a little bit closer so sure. We hear you better, please? We want to hear your testimony. Thank you.
Can I just continue from where I left off?
Yes, you
great.
Can.
I did my collaborative care work at North Suburban in Roseville, Lino Lakes, and also at the Health Partners Bloomington building. But I've talked to a number of psychiatrists who've been doing it rurally, where the problem and the need is much greater. I know some of my friends oftentimes have said they started doing some collaborative care, met the primary care clinic who was in a neighboring town, and the primary care doc has told them, I've never really actually sat down and talked with a psychiatrist about a patient before. It's so rare. And this really makes a world of difference for a psychiatrist. Typically, a psychiatrist either works inpatient or a CD unit. Otherwise, we're working in our office where we're kind of isolated, seeing patient after patient after patient. In this model, say I go to Lino Lakes, I'd spend an hour there, and I'd meet with the care manager in the primary care clinic. We'd go over every new patient that came in with whatever the disorder was. We'd go over other patients that weren't doing well, and we go over other patients, going through the list, and saying, well, you've been on this new antidepressant for 5 weeks now. Are you getting better? Do we need to change it? Do we need to modify the plan? And in doing so, I would be covering about 80 patients in an hour a week, versus if I was seeing somebody myself in my office, if it was a new patient, I'd see one. If it was a follow-up patient, I'd see three. So you can get a sense of the leverage and how it improves access. you know, and it wouldn't be limited to those. I would get in-basket or emails or phone calls from the care manager if somebody was having problems between times. We would spend significant time just trying to, you know, I almost felt like Sherlock Holmes sometimes, because I'm not seeing the patients, but the care manager is describing their history and stuff. And it was just always kind of interesting. They'd come in and they'd be depressed and anxious and not sleeping. And you'd have to sort of, with the care manager, kind of work through, well, you're having much caffeine during the day that might be adding to anxiety, or at night before you're trying to sleep. What are you doing with your sleep hygiene habits that we might want to think about, you know? Or do we need therapy for this, you know, and what kind of therapy makes sense, or medication, or maybe they were drinking too much, you know, and that helps you fall asleep, but then you get intermittent sleep and you wake up throughout the night. So it's not a matter of just saying, what's the med? It's working it through. It's teaching the team in the primary care clinic what to recognize, what information they need to get so it's available when you meet with them. And it's kind of fun, you know? What else do I want to say here? It's challenging. It's less isolating. The other thing I want to just highlight, it's some of the financial part. You know, 1 in 5 Minnesotans are on MA. And a little less than 50% of children are on MA in Minnesota. Now, if you're a clinic, when you're doing collaborative care, if private health plans pay for it, Medicare pays for it, but MA doesn't pay for it, you sort of either have a dilemma of, do I just see this patient anyway and we just don't get paid? Do I not see them? And I can tell you every primary clinic I've been in always does a pretty awful job of triaging people by insurance type, because the docs care, the nurses care, and they want to give everybody the treatment. And I think it's the right thing to do. But they suffer financially. And one of the reasons this hasn't spread in many states is because not everybody that comes in can you get paid to do it. And this is trying to correct something where basically all the major players would pay for it, which makes it much more likely the primary care clinics can remain whole and not lose money doing it and then saying, I don't really want to do this, we can't afford it, and get into all tied up in knots. So it's an easy way to leverage psychiatry. Psychiatrists like it. They'll sign up and want to do it. It helps a primary care clinic stay solvent, and it helps the primary care doc be much less isolated, and they like it a lot too. So I hope you vote for it.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. Would anyone else from the public like to testify on this bill? Okay, seeing none. Members, I will open it up to questions. And so public testimony is now closed. So members, I will open it up to questions and discussion. Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Nadeau. Apologies, these things are kind of coming apart. I will say, first of all, I do think that a collaborative care model is really helpful, and I appreciate this bill, Representative Nadeau. I think, you know, obviously we'll have to think about budget. That's a concern. But my only concern with this bill, honestly, I think it's a good bill, is really to that point that it might be a challenge to get enough providers to fulfill what we're asking here, but I don't think it's a reason we shouldn't try, and I think it's a good idea. So I really appreciate you bringing the bill forward.
Okay, next one is Representative Bierman.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to just ask about Dr. Arnell. You spoke about the graphs that you showed us about declining number of psychiatrists and rising number of patients. And maybe I missed it, but I just wanted to understand if you can sort of determine how many more patients you would be able to see as a psychiatrist in your normal work if you're just kind of focusing on that and you have the preliminary work from social workers or primary care, and what sort of improvement. Actually, Dr. Jadwin, you could answer this too, possibly, or Dr. Triangle as well.
Okay, one of you, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Bierman. caseloads can vary, kind of depend on the severity and maybe that hospital system as well. Most of our behavioral health care managers, they'll be working with anywhere from 50 to 100 patients at a time. As Dr. Triangle pointed out, in that hour consultation time every given week, for review within that hour, there's about 8 to 10 patients that get reviewed in that hour. But under that caseload, then around 80 would be folks that he is keeping an eye on with the assistance of the rest of the team here. So versus that one patient he may see in an individual hour, over the course of a month, they're maybe reviewing about 50 cases or so intentionally during that time, as he mentioned as well, others via other communication means outside of that hour could be keeping an eye on and monitoring their progress as well.
Thank you. Follow-up, yes. Representative Bierman.
Yes, please. First, I wanted to thank you for the education you provided when I went to Hennepin, and we had a good conversation on it. But for this this particular bill, and there was talk about how all the doctors are doing work that they're not able to bill for. My question here is, as patients present to you right now at Hennepin Healthcare, and you have the people in the building, is every patient now getting the coordinated care? So the coordinated care treatment with what you're doing now, and you're just not getting paid for it, is that fair to say, or what would you?
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Mr. Jadwin, go ahead.
At Hennepin Healthcare, we're currently operating in partnership with DHS under a large SAMHSA grant, and that's what's allowing us to offer these services to our patients. There are specific inclusion criteria that are part of this model, so it isn't a guarantee for everybody to come in and receive this service. That is made between the doctor, the primary care provider, and the patient, if this would be the right approach for them. I think where we see it most common would be in instances where somebody comes, they screen positive for depression in their visit, routine screening if you have a primary care provider. I trust you've taken a PH29 and seen the results as that relates to a depression. If that screening comes in high and there's considerations of starting medication, just the consideration, that would be a great referral into the collaborative care model, where you would meet with the behavioral health care manager. They could talk about other treatment options, including what the collaborative care model would look like. We'd bring that case for consultation with psychiatry, who could keep an eye on it. If the patient does express an interest in medication, then that recommendation can be brought back to the primary care provider after a chart review, full consideration of other physical health conditions that may be present or other medications being taken, and they can find the right medication for that person. And then the frequent contacts thereafter are just ensuring that it's a good fit, adherence to that medication, and any concerns of side effects as well.
Can I have one more?
Yes, go ahead.
Thank you. And then final question in relating to what Representative Bonner spoke about and the lack of providers out in rural areas. How do you see this being able to be spread in rural areas, whether it's through some telehealth or, you know, I know teaching from larger systems and just making that advantageous for primary care use in more rural areas?
Mr. Jadwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The psychiatric consultant role is absolutely part of the collaborative care model team, but doesn't necessarily always have to be a member of that same organization. And that's where we see the opportunities in greater Minnesota for health systems to utilize this. So they can contract with that referring, that consulting psychiatrist there to meet this component of the model. And so therefore the behavioral health care manager on the team could reach out to this person on a contract basis. That can be via telehealth or phone calls. The care delivery itself is allowed by any means, so those can be phone conversations. For those more therapeutic conversations, they can be virtual appointments and certainly in person as well.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So from what I've heard today, better outcomes, minimized gaps in care, better management of chronic conditions, reduced healthcare costs, reduced hospital admissions, increased adherence to medical treatments, prevention of medical errors, enhanced patient satisfaction. What else you got?
Provider satisfaction.
Very good. Thank you very much.
And at least for depression, the results are better, but they're also quicker.
Very good. Thank you, Representative Nadeau, for bringing the bill forward.
Yep. Just remind everybody, we'll go everything through the chair, please. So we have one more. Representative Hewitt, you are on deck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm having some reservations here because maybe it's me not understanding, and I'm looking at this maybe in a scope situation, whereas 1.8 of the DE, you state that formal education or specialized training in behavioral health. As somebody that was that specialized training in EMS, I had a license. I always had something that if I screwed up, I knew I could lose. I respect the fact that all this falls under the physician sitting at the table here to oversee this, but we're talking about health managers, we're talking about terms that I've never heard in this space, and I've worked in mental health. Can you kind of tell me what we're digging at? I mean, is this a psych tech? Is this a, you know, what are we going to give responsibilities to? And I know you're the bottom line, but is that what we're doing? I mean, could I do a telemedicine visit with a psych tech? Put me at ease here a little bit, Mr. Chair.
I'm assuming, Chad, when you're taking this one. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That component of it, so the way that we have drafted up the credentials when it's a mental health presentation, we follow the allowed definition for the existing 245I statute, which basically licensed mental health professionals, psychologists, psychiatrists, clinical social workers, licensed marriage and family therapists, and professional counselors. There's also allowances for practitioners, clinical trainees under certain supervision. 245I is an updated statute that defines our mental health services in the state of Minnesota. So we just went with that existing definition for who can render the services in collaborative care model for mental health purposes. For the part that you mentioned specific there, we made an adjustment when treating substance use disorders. So that would be a licensed addiction counselor who report through the Board of Behavioral Health and Therapy, as well as registered nurses with specific training. The reason for the registered nurses component is because in substance use treatment, more and more that medication-assisted treatment becomes an option. It would be out of scope for me as a clinical social worker to give specific recommendations around medications or any adjustments and triage anything related to medications. But that's within a nurse's scope. And so we found if somebody is new to Suboxone or their long-acting injectable or any other medication-assisted treatment, it's best to have a nurse there who has it within their scope to facilitate those conversations around the medications. So certainly anybody involved in rendering the services that behavioral health care manage has those credentials at the end of their name, but they can vary. And the way we design it is kind of what's most appropriate depending on if it falls more towards the mental health lane or substance use lane.
A follow-up?
You put me at ease. Thank you, and I see where you're going with it. I really appreciate this. I would support this, as all of you said, in my visits around the state, in my own personal experience, we're short. And if this helps us get more people, more help, I definitely could see this being a great bill. But again, I'm with my colleagues over here. It all comes down to the money. So thank you very much. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Okay, we have next question. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Bierman's list of advantages made me think of this question. And, you know, if you aren't prepared to answer this, it's fine. But in one of my other roles here, I just was talking to folks from the Competency Attainment Board, which is for those who don't know, it's something that was recently passed to try to help deal with folks in the criminal justice system who have some kind of mental challenges or behavioral challenges and need some intervention in order to complete their court process and move on. And I just thought, as you were describing this, what sounds like a really great program, whether there's any applicability here to that. I don't know if anybody's thought. If you haven't thought about it, or just say so, but just thought I'd ask.
Mr. Jadwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Certainly some applicability. Hennepin Healthcare, they have a jail health services. And in our work, we've created a pipeline from the jail health services into our general internal medicine primary care, so that somebody who maybe will start with a certain treatment, especially, again, as it comes to addictions and medication-assisted treatment, the importance of maintaining that is critical, because those medications are basically preventing that person from cravings oftentimes, but also the withdrawal symptoms if we're talking about something like an opioid use disorder. So making sure that those people can start a medication in the jails, maintain their sobriety, and have a care of their plan, their care plan, be continued upon the release is very important. The counseling component would really depend on the conditions. So if it's a supervised release or probation, depending on what that recommendation was made, that would be a different conversation. Certainly sometimes the way that it's framed is a recommendation for psychotherapy, and the procedural codes used with collaborative care model don't match those for psychotherapy, so that would be distinct.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. And our final question today will be from Representative Barner. Go ahead, please.
Representative Keeler.
Oh.
I put my hand up.
Did you have a question, Representative Barner?
I did, but it was for nonpartisan staff.
Okay.
But Representative Keeler, I think, had
a question. Oh, we did not. Okay. We'll go down, way down to Representative Keeler. Go ahead, please. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I have a question. I represent Moorhead, Border City. We are actually in very large conversations about a youth psychiatric residential treatment facility in the hopes that we can actually become a mental health mecca on the side of the state, because we know that we just don't have these services. With that, we tend to lean into North Dakota for a lot of our health care. When we talk about these psychiatric consultations, is it just within Minnesota borders, or would a border city like mine be able to lean into health care professionals that are within minutes from us in Fargo, or is this all Minnesota-based? And then the second question I have is, you mentioned that you work with the U of M. Is that the only education institution you work with? Because, again, if we're going to reach greater Minnesota, that's not really the health institution or the higher education institution that really does the most affordable work in educating our individuals in greater Minnesota. So two questions, Mr. Chair.
Okay, whoever wants to take that. Looks like you're on deck again, Mr. Jadwin. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the first part of the question, in state, in providing the services, since these are licensed professionals, they are required to be practicing with patients in the state where they are licensed.
If we're dual licensed.
In two states? Mm-hmm. Then that would be allowed. I think the other consideration here for the service rendered, that it's what's called an incident to service, which means that it happens under the NPI of the medical provider. So this care at the end of the month is assembled for its time. A coding team would attach the procedure codes to it, and that is how you create the claim for that. So the location of the doctor who is running that service is what's most important there. But when it comes to consultation with the psychiatrist,
Go ahead, Mr. Triangle.
The psychiatrist would be any psychiatrist can contract with the primary care clinic to consult to them. And they're not delivering medical care to the patient directly. So you don't have to worry about that. It happens across state lines.
Okay. Follow up, Representative Keeler.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the answer, but then it just created another kind of concern in my mind, right? So where are we contracting these psychiatric professionals from? Can you tell us what other states we're contracting from? The only reason that I ask is, now you're saying that, yes, we can do the consultations without a state. What I fear is, are we doing these consultations with individuals who are, in Alabama, Texas, individuals who really just don't know what we're doing with our patient care here in Minnesota?
No.
Mr. Triangle, go ahead.
Yeah. No. I mean, there have been out-of-state psychiatrists that do televideo medicine for patients, but then they have to get licensed in Minnesota to do it if they live in another state. This is just consulting to the care manager and the primary care team and doctor.
Did you have another question, Representative Keeler?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for clarifying that. I just, my brain went to this thing that now we have, everybody having conversations. I do, though, if we can get back to the higher education question, that is an important question I'd like answered.
Well,
Mr. Terrangle, go ahead.
Hennepin County and Regents have a residency program, and I know some of the residents are getting trained in collaborative care model as part of that as well.
Mr. Jadwin?
And Mayo also does collaborative care, but it's grant supported, and they struggle financially with MA payment as well.
And it's...
Go ahead, Mr. Jadwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's a very valid question. In a state that doesn't recognize this as a Medicaid benefit, few are very trained and well-equipped to provide the service. I did my earlier professional career outside of the state of Minnesota and Colorado, and I taught integrated behavioral health there and helped create that pipeline to better perform in integrated behavioral health services. I noticed coming back to Minnesota, we're absent that. So I've had conversations with the Master of Social Work programs here in Minnesota, signed letter support for their integrated behavioral health training efforts throughout the master's level clinician community, so those professional counselors, social workers, marriage and family therapists, and psychologists, there are increasingly more integrated behavioral health treatment or training options and education options for them. So that's the care manager role, and similar to what Dr. Trangle mentioned, we have residents for psychiatry also touring through our collaborative care now starting this year since we've started the service at Hennepin Health. So we're training that pipeline as well, and certainly medical residents in the resident clinic are getting exposed to it as well.
Okay, we're going to keep this moving. I do appreciate questions. Representative Bonner, you're nonpartisan. Are you able to take that offline? Or no?
Mr. Chair, I will just point it out and let nonpartisan address it. You know, in the spirit of collaboration, I just wanted to point out, you know, our staff does a great job, but I think on lines 4.1 through 4.2, it refers to the rates required under subdivision 6. And I just wonder if that should have been subdivision 5, but nonpartisan can probably address that.
Ms. Mock, I think it is correct. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, we will take a closer look at that and make sure it's correct. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you for pointing that out. See no further discussion. Vice Chair Nagdeau, please close on your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members, for this great discussion. And yes, we have requested a fiscal note for this bill. My hope is that it's going to come back at a reasonable level that we're going to be able to extend this benefit to our MA population in Minnesota. Currently, I believe that many patients are receiving these services through current CPT codes, but they're not in a collaborative manner. I think Mr. Representative Bierman probably did a better close than I did, but please support the bill. And
I'll take care of it for me.
All right, thank you. Thank you, members.
Okay. Boy, you were chair last committee and just want to continue. So anyway, thank you. The chair renews his motion that House File 958, as referred to committee, will be referred to the Committee on Human Service, Finance, and Policy as amended. So all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed say nay. Okay, the motion prevails. And you are off to Human Services. Thank you. Okay, folks, next on the agenda is House File 953, as we are waiting for folks to move around. And House File 953 is from Representative West. Now, the chair, while Representative West comes to the table, the chair moves House File 953 before the committee with the chair's intent to lay the bill over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill or further action at a later date. Representative West, before you get started, we have a DE-1-1 author's amendment to get the bill in the shape you would like. So the chair moves to adopt the DE-1-1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed say nay. The motion prevails and the DE-1-1 is adopted. Representative West, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the committee for hearing this bill and getting it in the shape that I would like it. House File 953 is about educating parents on recognizing signs of abuse in infants. So, as many of you may or may not know, my child Sybil, which you see pictures of her, was abused. Man, I'm a lot better at this.
You're okay.
She was abused, well, the court case is ongoing, but she was abused at daycare in Blaine, and one of my biggest regrets is not understanding how to recognize abuse. It is something that we do as education on, well, on shaken baby syndrome. You have that at birth at the hospital, and that's what the original bill was based off of, is recognizing we can put this education with shaken baby syndrome at birth or in the clinics. And with the DE, we move that to the first well visit for the child. And that's because shaken baby syndrome, you do need to know right away. Like, you need to know the second you handle a new life how to care for it. And we don't necessarily want to be have people thinking about abuse immediately after bringing beautiful life into the world. So moving it to the first well visit is a good time for parents to be educated. Now, I worked with both the Hospital Association and the Minnesota Department of Health because I am very serious about getting this bill passed. And I want to thank some of my DFL co-authors for supporting me in this endeavor because that's very appreciated and I take it very seriously. But without this education, well, as it stands now, Sybil's incident came months before they discovered the other cases. And it turns out there's over a dozen cases in this at her daycare that resulted in over five felony charges for two individuals. And had I known, had my family known about how to recognize bruising in particular, because with kids, I always grew up with, kids get bruises, happens. Mm-hmm. Immobile infants don't get bruises. So I didn't know that, and if we had known that, we could have intervened much earlier, and this didn't come to light until a baby's leg was fractured. Thank God, not my little girl, but that happened to Representative Feist's constituent. So this bill is needed. I can definitely point to how we could have prevented direct abuse had parents been educated on this, and I have a number of testifiers here to really drive the point home, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative West. We do have three testifiers. So first we have Ms. Megan West. And then after that, we have Susan Dickinson and then Ms. Janice DeConda. So, Ms. West, if you could approach, sit next to your husband.
And Sloan West is here as well.
Good. And please state your name for the record. And we ask you to do your best to keep your testimony to around 4 minutes, please. Thank you.
My name is Megan West. Nolan West is my husband. I'm a pharmacist and a mom. And as Nolan mentioned, our daughter Sybil was a victim of abuse at a child care center in Blaine. Sybil was coming home from daycare less than a month after she started there with suspicious bruising on her legs, on her abdomen. And I took pictures of several of those bruises because I was suspicious. I discussed these bruises with some of my other family members who told me bruising happens, it's normal. So I didn't want to imagine the worst. So I didn't do anything at the time. I kept the pictures because, again, I was suspicious of what had happened. Later, we found out the two infant teachers at that daycare were arrested of abuse of over a dozen infants, resulting in five felony charges, one of which was for our daughter, Sybil. This bill is needed because a lot of parents, including us, did not know that any bruising on an infant that's not walking is not normal. Had we known this, we would have done something sooner. And it's something easy enough as educating parents when they have a new baby at their first appointment, just like we were educated in the hospital about shaken baby syndromes and the dangers of that. A lot of infants were hurt because of the lack of knowledge of something simple as educating parents, and we'd like to prevent this in the future. So please support this bill.
Thank you. Thank you very much for that. Our next on deck is Ms. Suzanne Dickinson. If you could come to the table and state your name for the record, and thank you for testifying.
Mr. Chair, if I could.
Oh, go ahead. Representative West.
I brought this for the committee.
Yeah, take one, pass it around.
I must abide by the committee rules.
So Representative
if
West,
page could distribute these.
I think you should have taught Representative Rapisky something, because He came with nothing. I mean, and he expects us to approve or something. No, I'm just saying. Okay, thank you. Go ahead. I'm Suzanne Dickinson. State your name for the record and ask you to keep your testimony to 4 minutes.
My name is Suzanne Dickinson.
And you may want to get a little closer to the mic, please.
Okay. Is that better?
Yes, we want to be able to hear you. Thank you so much.
My granddaughter was also at the daycare that Mr. West is talking about. The education and learning should never stop for parents. I'm 55. I didn't even know what we needed to know. Until my granddaughter's abuse at Small World Learning Center, I had no clue of what steps should be taken or who to call to report suspect injuries. They had already spoken several times to a director of the center, but nothing changed. The excuse and many incident reports were at first possible. Scratches, cuts, and abrasions could have occurred due to her ever fast growing nails. And trust me, I know I got one or two really good ones. But it was always rectified immediately, so how was it possible to keep happening? My greatest hope every day is that no other family will ever have to try to survive through what mine has since July, and there's no end in sight. With being educated, I believe that no Nana like me will ever need to hear her namesake scream at the emergency room as they hold her down for testing, or while they, sorry, or while they did the pictures to document the bruises that were all over her body. They had to test to ensure her body was intact and that her little brain was not permanently damaged. Worse is that no one will ever have to seek forgiveness for failing their only daughter and their premature granddaughter as I have been doing every day since this began. We need to pass this to save the kids. Thanks.
Thank you for sharing that. I know that was difficult. Next on deck, next is Janice DeGana. Okay, thank you for your help there, Ms. DeGana. Yeah. And then we have also one more, I understand, Crystal McNally after Ms. Danga. Go ahead, state your name and proceed with your testimony.
Hi, my name is Janice DeGanda, and my daughter was also abused at the daycare with Mr. West. If it was not for the severity of her bruises that were throughout her entire body, we would not have taken her in to get looked at, which then started this investigation. I feel that it is important to be educated on these signs of this abuse, because if we knew what to look for, we could have potentially stopped the abuse on our daughter, but also for the other families involved. Parents should know the signs so that we can fully advocate for our children and for the other children that attend daycares. We need to be able to hold the abusers accountable and be able to tell the difference from abuse versus just simple accidents that might happen. And we need to be able to know that our children are safe when they are not in our care. And then we need to know the knowledge to know when they're not being safe, especially when they are so young and cannot voice it themselves. As a first-time parent, if we knew what to look for, we could have stopped it and prevented anyone else from being harmed. Thank you.
Thank you for sharing that. And then we had a Crystal McNally. Are you in the audience? Oh, okay, you are. Thank you. Please approach, state your name for the record, and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Crystal McNally. I am the executive director and founder of Never Shake Minnesota. Never Shake Minnesota is a relatively new nonprofit that serves families in Minnesota. But most importantly, I'm the mother of a survivor. My son's name is Nolan, so funny coincidence. On September 14th, 2017, I got the worst call of my life from daycare, that my son was not breathing. He ended up being abused by his in-home daycare provider, which was someone we had trusted for a very long time with all of our children. He was my third child. He suffered a traumatic brain injury, a brain bleed, so a subdural hematoma, a skull fracture, a broken sternum, and bruising all over his legs. My husband and I started Never Shake Minnesota with one goal, and that was to make Minnesota a Never Shake state. So we hope to put our nonprofit out of business, as you say. But Never Shake does two things. We provide financial support to survivors of shaken baby syndrome, or also known as abusive head trauma, but we also educate. So the hope is that we can educate parents, caregivers, and the public about the dangers of shaking a baby. 25% of shaken baby victims die. They do not survive. 70% are impaired. 40% are so severely impaired that they will not be able to live on their own. But the saddest statistic is that it's 100% preventable. And that's where the education comes into play. The education that House File 953 presents is vital in helping to reduce and prevent abuse. It empowers parents and caregivers to keep kids safe and is a great first step in making Minnesota a never shake state. Many are fortunate enough to not know about shaken baby syndrome or abusing and bruises in infants. But for us that have experienced it firsthand, that are all here today, it's traumatizing, heartbreaking, and it shatters the lives of babies and kids in Minnesota. Parents should be educated, and the public must understand the dangers. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. Would anyone else from the public like to testify? Okay, members, I will open it up to questions and discussion. Representative Carroll.
Thank you, Chair. And Representative West, I'm so sorry for the experience that you had. It breaks my heart. I remember talking to you outside the House floor and you telling me that you were expecting and how excited you were about it. Mm-hmm. And I shared stories about being a father of three daughters and what a wonderful experience it is and was and hopefully will continue to be. They're challenging. That's why I say hope to be. But in any event, it breaks my heart that you went through this. So the question, I think this is a great bill. The question I have for you is there something magical about the six-month period as opposed to maybe a year or some other? Why did you draw the line at 6 months?
Representative West.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Carroll. So the original bill was very prescriptive. If you look, it said like written materials and had the commissioner must develop and had all these very prescriptive way of doing it, and I wanted to avoid costs. So then I worked with the department on this DE, and the department actually provided the bulk of the language you see here today, and I am very appreciative for their help. Getting it, I want it to work. I don't want any logistical issues. And the result of that work came with the 6 months, so there was actually not a specific angle. There was talk about maybe we wanted another, like two visits or do it at 1 year and at their first well visit. But I'm also very cognizant of a requirement on a pediatrician to do, like, just any kind of mandate on what a doctor has to do or a nurse or anybody. And it's my understanding there wasn't a requirement of any kind in this setting, or maybe not any kind, but in this variety, in this particular setting. So I was trying to, I didn't mind the six-month window because I wanted to keep it narrow. I don't want, like, somebody to get in trouble for not doing this or something like that.
Thank you.
Okay, good. Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Chair. Representative West, thank you for bringing this forward. I actually just emailed my LA to be added to the bill because we do have to talk about this. I actually went through a course when I was licensed for foster care that talked about the importance of it, and it's crazy how much you just think we know and we don't. And as parents, we're our biggest protector of our kids. So thank you for this. I do have a couple questions because
I know that educating ourselves is one component. Reporting is another component. And so would you mind, so I know in 1.16 it talks about the signs of abuse, but then also how to report it. Do you think in our state we have a robust reporting mechanism? So when parents are educated and see these signs, the next step of reporting, we're doing that well in the state, or do you think that's an area we still need to address?
Representative West.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Keeler, I do believe that's an area we need to continue to address. I would say it's functional, but particularly, you might have been involved in this bill as well, but Representative Nash, yep, worked to get, and the preventing any kind of locking and mandating 40, we made a little step in that direction, but as you'll hear in this, if you look into the Small World Learning Center case, there was another teacher in the older infant room that had a child in the younger infant room who also had concerns who were also ignored. So the mandate, like, I can't imagine the mandating reporting, we're actually hearing a bill on that in my committee at 3, to enhance the training of mandated reporters, because there is work to do. So you're on the right track there.
Representative Keeler.
No more questions, but just, I agree. I think we need to do more, and happy to join into the fight to make sure that we protect our kids together. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative West, I join my colleagues in saying my heart really goes out to you and, of course, to the other families and victims of this. I mean, I remember so well having young kids, and when you send them off to somebody else's care, it's terrifying. And it's, you know, you just worry all the time. And now, and I have grandchildren, same situation. You just worry all the time. And so really my question to you is about, I mean, this is good. It's good to educate parents. I mean, I know there's so many things that learning to be a parent is a big, big deal and not that easy on so many dimensions, right? And this is like a parent's worst nightmare. I really feel so bad for those that this has happened to. And, you know, I can, we all feeling it in the room. I know we are. But the question I have for you is, you work on children and youth issues. I know you're chairing the Children Youth Committee now. And I'm just wondering, since, you know, my grandkids now, when they went to daycare, they're now young school age, but there were a lot of cameras in the rooms. And there's just technology now that, now obviously not every child care setting, because they're still at home daycare and this and that, but I'm just wondering if you could just give us, like, very briefly, are there other things that we should be doing that you're working on to try to address this kind of thing? Because, you know, if you had a camera in the room, you can check in. I know my kids have done this with their kids, look in on what's happening in that room periodically.
Representative West.
Mr. Chair, I'm very enthusiastic about this question, but I know it's not perfectly purview to the committee, but I am going to answer it as much as you'll let me, because I'm very happy you asked. The reviser is working on some stuff on this very issue. One in particular is, you know, we talked about dozens of infants in this, or more than a dozen infants in this particular case, and one had a fractured leg. There's talk of trying to pin that where we believe it happened is difficult, because that didn't occur in the window in which they kept footage. They only kept footage for a week. Mm-hmm. So if we had a longer retention period, not just the camera aspect, but a longer retention period, it would be so much easier to hold people accountable. My daughter generated a felony charge. We have to work to make that stick, but we have before and after pictures and whatnot. We don't have something that's on video. So I will be working specifically on those camera issues. And one thing I think it's important for everyone to know is the retention period is what's important. Because what we see in these cases is usually, and I'm shocked that this is the case, extended periods of abuse. That it becomes a habit of the supposed caregivers. And, well, it's like, oh, we'll still catch them. Well, like, I've had people critique it, and I accept critiques.
I don't say you hate my children, like, so let's have a reason, we can have a reasonable discussion. But they say, oh, you're just catching them. You're not preventing, you're just catching them after the fact. So this is part of me going like, okay, well, let's try and work from this angle, not just from that angle. But it's important to have that footage so you can see and build a case, because sometimes you need a lot. I mean, there's attorneys in this room that know. You need a lot of evidence to get anywhere in criminal court. And without cameras, I don't believe these individuals would see any of this if not for the cameras that were in the room.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you. Well, seeing no further discussion, right before closing, we do appreciate the testifiers on this. These are difficult topics, but it's something that's important to do. So thank you for moving this forward. Wes, of course, we would never, Representative Wes, never would wish you or anybody else to be in those circumstances, but using this to help others. So hats off to that. So with that, Representative Wes, please close on your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for hearing this bill. Really appreciate it. I've been working with the Minnesota Hospital Association and the Department of Health because the goal is to make this a minimal burden, but it's one of those small things, like how small things that I think can make a really big difference. So my hope was to have a fiscal note that says there's no cost. We're working on that. I really wanted this to move by itself because who knows how things will fold out in the legislature. It gets really nervous, and I think it's something everyone can get behind if we can find a way to make it work in that cost. And I know the department's hasn't said it's going to cost, but they still need more time to evaluate it. So that aspect of this is still going, and I welcome any feedback, and particularly I love that Representative Liebling brought up the camera issue, because that is another thing that I will be talking about vigorously and would greatly appreciate support of everyone in this building. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, thank you, Representative West. The chair lays over House File 953 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill or future consideration at a later date. So thank you, Representative West. Members, next on the agenda is House File 981 for Representative Bierman. While he is getting to the table, Representative Bierman moves House File 981 before the committee with the chair's intent to lay the bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill or for further consideration at a later date. To your bill, Representative Bierman.
Nolan.
What?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. I would just like to introduce House File number 981. Members, Minnesota counties continue to experience a devastating opioid and addiction crisis. Opioid addiction affects our families in every single corner of the state. Kids are using. They have friends who use. They see family members struggling in active addiction, and they need to know how to recognize the signs, respond effectively, and seek help. While overdose deaths have declined, thanks in part to increased naloxone availability, non-fatal overdoses have increased by 11%. House File 981 provides $500,000 annually to change the outcome, an organization dedicated to educating students on the dangers of opioid use, emerging drug trends, and providing overdose prevention. This funding will allow Change the Outcome to expand its educational program in middle and high schools around Minnesota. Since launching in 2017, they've been in over 120 schools and have spoken to over 110,000 students in Minnesota. Change the Outcome uses evidence-based instruction on opioid dangers, prevention strategies, tips for recognizing overdoses, and tools to respond with life-saving interventions. They deliver compelling real-life stories and factual information that resonate with students and communities. This programming empowers young people with knowledge and strategies to make informed, life-saving decisions. Schools and communities that have worked with Change the Outcome report increased awareness and engagement in prevention efforts. This bill is a proactive step in addressing Minnesota's opioid crisis by equipping young people with the knowledge and tools to make safe choices. I want to thank Chair Backer and Representative Gilman and Representative Purcell for co-authoring House File 981. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn it over to my testifiers, please.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Representative Bierman. We have right now three testifiers. We have Ms. Ronnie. Hopefully I'm doing that right. And then after that will be Ms. Wagner and then Ms. Hasted. So please state your name and your testimony. Try to keep it to about 4 minutes. Go ahead. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Representative Bierman, Chair Backer, and all members of the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. I greatly appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today about House File 981 to appropriate funding for opioid prevention education. My name is Colleen Ronnie. I am the founder and executive director of Change the Outcome. I am also a parent who has lost a child to the opioid epidemic. As I'm sure you all know, I'm not alone. Thousands of Minnesotans have lost loved ones due to overdoses. Having the company of so many who understand this crushing loss doesn't bring me comfort, but it has inspired me to work as hard as I can. To prevent it from happening to others. Our son Luke was 20 years old when he experienced a fatal overdose in our home in 2016. His addiction began when he was prescribed opiates for pain and after oral surgery and an infection that followed. His struggle was heartbreaking, but he worked hard to recover. I'm sorry, the previous testimony made me very emotional, and now I'm a little out of sorts. Like any parent, I asked myself where things went wrong. What did we miss? How could I let this happen? And how can I keep it from happening to others? In the aftermath of Luke's death, it was crushing to realize just how incredibly ill-equipped we were in terms of understanding the risks of even legitimately prescribed narcotics and how they can lead to substance use disorder. As awful as it was, the ignorance made sense. 10 years ago, not enough people were talking about the opioid epidemic. No school in Minnesota had curricula devoted to raising awareness or understanding of one of the biggest health crises our state is facing. Too many young people have lost their lives because of a lack of education. In the months after Luke died, I connected with some dedicated folks at the FBI and Hennepin County drug courts who shared my belief that we owed it to kids to provide them with the knowledge and tools they need to successfully navigate the ever-changing landscape of substance use and how mental health plays a role in decisions to try or use substances. Education is a dreadfully underutilized tool in our fight against fentanyl in Minnesota. We don't want that to continue. So with those folks, we worked together to create a pilot program to deliver prevention education in two school districts. That quickly evolved into Change the Outcome. It was the beginning of a small but mighty effort that is saving lives. While it was challenging to get schools to open their doors to us in 2018, today we simply can't keep up. We have grown from partnering with 8 schools in our first year to more than 100 schools this year. As Rep. Bierman mentioned, we presented to more than 110,000 middle and high school students, educators, parents, and community members. 15,000 so far just this year since school started. I believe so strongly in this effort that my husband and I personally supported it for the first several years. We also received private donations and small grants and help from other congresspeople and representatives. In 2021, we received our first 3-year grant from Minnesota's Opioid Epidemic Response Advisory Council. Back then, 4 organizations applied for the grant. During the last funding round in August, there were 26 applicants. And while we received a second grant, which I'm tremendously grateful for, it was 30% less than the previous one, despite the fact that we're doing twice as much work, or trying to.
Ongoing funding appears uncertain, but our school partners are counting on us, and I'm committed to making sure that we have a sustainable program and can continue to support and serve them and students with our programming in a consistent manner, no matter where they are located in the state. That is why House File 981 is so important and why I'm here today. Unfortunately, the opioid epidemic is not going away anytime soon. Supporting youth and educators with impactful, relevant, and sustainable prevention education is the right and fiscally responsible thing to do. Our Director of Programming, Megan Wagner, will tell you more about what we're doing in classrooms throughout the state of Minnesota.
Thank you. Megan, you're next. State your name and go with your testimony. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Megan Wagner. Good afternoon, Chair Backer and distinguished members of the Health Finance and Policy Committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I am the Director of Programming at Change the Outcome. I am grateful for the committee's ongoing commitment to addressing these critical issues, and I'm honored to speak before you today. My career began as an educator with Minneapolis Public Schools before I returned to the University of Minnesota to earn my master's in integrated behavioral health. Before joining Change the Outcome, I worked in various settings as a licensed alcohol and drug counselor, including inpatient psychiatry at Hennepin Healthcare, a school district in the South Metro, and both residential and outpatient treatment facilities. Over the past 20 years, I've had the privilege of working with Minnesotans from all walks of life, and those experiences have deepened my commitment to this work. One of the most important lessons that I've learned from my clinical experience is the value of intervention and prevention. The adults and students I've worked with who struggle with mental health and substance misuse and disorders often share a common theme. They lacked crucial, factual information that could have empowered them to make safer decisions about substances. This is exactly why the work that Change the Outcome is doing every day in schools across the state is so vital. From International Falls to Battle Lake to Bloomington and Rochester, we are proud to share that we serve schools in almost all of your districts. By providing young people with the knowledge and skills they need earlier in life, we can help them avoid the challenges that many wish they had been equipped to overcome. This work is truly transforming lives. Our unique program, created for middle and high schoolers, features locally produced documentary, The Reality of Hope. Following the film, students hear from relatable young people who share their lived experiences while using evidence-based information to educate and empower the students. Our program works because it focuses on the power of recovery and the possibility of change, rather than the more common fear-based approach. Research shows us that when messages rely on scare tactics, they often feel exaggerated or unrealistic to young people, making them less likely to take the information seriously and ultimately tends to create resistance rather than understanding. To measure our impact in the classroom, we use pre- and post-surveys. The data we collect, compiled into a survey analysis report and shared directly with our school contact, clearly demonstrates how we are educating and empowering young people to make safer, healthier decisions, undoubtedly saving lives in the process. On all the topics that we cover, including but not limited to Narcan, Steve's Law, recognizing signs of an overdose, and press pills, student understanding increases 40 to 60%. The data goes beyond knowledge. It also speaks to students' sense of confidence and their belief in the importance of this education. 95% of the students that we work with report feeling more informed about current substance use risks after our program. 94% of students believe others their age would benefit from the program. I want to leave you with a couple more statistics that I find staggering. During the 24-25 school year, 50% of students report knowing someone who has struggled with a substance use disorder. And 31% of middle and high school students report knowing somebody who has experienced an overdose. These statistics reflect not just trends, but the lived experiences of young people who are facing real dangers every day. Their stories matter. They need prevention, education, and the support that they need is urgent. The crisis facing our communities is undeniable, and it's crucial that we maintain our focus and continue our efforts to address it. With your support, we can continue equipping young people across Minnesota with the knowledge and tools they need to navigate a world increasingly affected by substance misuse, ensuring our data-driven program's real impact grows and reaches even more communities. Thank you for your time, consideration, and together we can change the outcome for so many across our great state. Thank you.
Okay, thank you there. Next, Sydney Hasted. Go ahead, state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony. Thank you.
Yep, thank you. Hello, my name is Sydney Hasted, and I'm an outreach coordinator and program facilitator at Change Outcome. I've been a part of Change Outcome for almost 3 years, taking on a role of scheduling schools and being one of the young adults that shares their personal experience in the classroom as it relates to the opioid overdose epidemic. I'm here today representing a dedicated team of young adults who share the same mission to combat this crisis. We all come from diverse backgrounds, each with our own unique stories. Whether we are currently in active recovery from opioid use or have been deeply affected by a loved one's substance use. I find this work extremely meaningful and important because I have been personally affected by the disease of addiction. I have many loved ones that have struggled with substance use, and unfortunately, I have lost a number of friends due to their addiction. Clean son Luke being one of them. I'm a member of the Lukuturi tribe and have seen firsthand how this epidemic is impacting my community at a much larger scale. And quite frankly, I see the impact this opioid epidemic is having on students throughout the state of Minnesota. I've been in hundreds of classrooms in both the metro area as well in rural communities. It doesn't matter where they live. The students I see and talk with have been impacted in some way by substance use disorder. Many have parents or siblings who struggle. Some are struggling themselves. It is not uncommon to have students come up to us after our conversation with them and have them share their personal experiences or ask for more resources. I thought it would be helpful for you to hear a few of the comments that students have shared in our surveys that demonstrate how our program resonates with them. So this first comment is from an Eastview High School student that states, "I know people that have struggled and are still struggling with addiction. This program ensures that I can help keep them safe and help them get better. Thank you so much." The second comment is from an Ivan Sand Community High Schooler that states, "It helped me understand more about drugs and addiction, and it actually brought up some of my past. I could relate to it so much, and it helped me understand more about what was going on." And then recently, we had a student from Elk River share that he had broken his arm in the summer, and he was going to be prescribed an opioid for the pain. He told us that he thought about all the things we had taught him in his health class months prior and advocated for himself to take an alternative medication for the pain because he knew he was at a higher risk for developing a substance use disorder. And then he proceeded to thank us. These are just a few examples that demonstrate the impact our education has on students. It is crucial that we continue to educate youth about the devastating effects of opioids and substance use disorders. We are currently booked and sometimes double booked until the end of the school year to meet the dire need for this program. I believe that by sharing our lived experiences, we can provide a real, honest view of the struggles and challenges so many young people are facing. This is not just about statistics. It's about understanding the human toll this epidemic takes on individuals, families, and our communities. Our hope with this bill is that it will help to ensure that the next generation is equipped with knowledge to make informed decisions about substance use and avoid the pitfalls that so many of us have faced. By opening up these conversations in schools, we give students that opportunity to learn, empathize, and ultimately help break the cycle of addiction that impacts so many. House File 981 will allow Change the Outcome to continue to build our capacity to travel, expand, and reach more schools and students throughout the state of Minnesota. Thank you so much for listening to me today.
Thank you for sharing that. Public, would anyone else from the public like to testify? Okay, I'm seeing none, so public testimony is now closed. Members, I will open up to questions and discussions. We have Representative Doe.
Thank you, Representative Bierman. And this question is for you. I'm curious. I completely agree with the premise of this bill. We don't spend a lot of time in schools educating kids. And I'm looking at the, you know, from where Hennepin, we have some very robust opioid prevention and response programs. And the last time I looked, I don't think there was any in a school. So I love this. But my question has to do with why are we using general fund dollars? Why not ORAC dollars? Why not some of the settlement dollars that the counties get? Why not some of the, you know, the dedicated opioid fund dollars? I mean, we're spending an enormous amount of money on opioids. And this is a super hard thing to measure. You know, what are we trying to measure? The number of people that are actually, you know, getting into recovery? Are we trying to decrease ED visits, ED deaths? I mean, I think if you look at the statistics, you know, those ED deaths are coming down. But that's not because of intervention and outreach. It's because of Narcan. You know, we're saving people's lives, and that is a really good thing. We're starting to put, you know, we have public safety approaches, we have criminal justice approaches, we have Department of Health approaches, we have Department of Human Service approaches, all around opioids. And I would love this bill more if we were taking that $500,000 and literally, you know, providing a who's doing what and where. And how often and how frequently. So I mean, it's important. What we're doing here is important, but I'm really concerned with this, the randomness of where we are today with what we're doing. So I guess my question is, why aren't we using existing funds?
Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Chair Backer. Thank you for the question. And so I am on a new member of the Opioid Epidemic Response Advisory Council. I've been on there a few months now, and just sort of getting my feet wet and understanding how those funds have been dispersed in the past and what their formulation is going forward. So they have a portion of that funding that they get that they can then vet all sorts of applications that come forward. There was a plethora of bills programs that were put forth to the council, and we went through that process of the vetting and doling out the funds that we had. I think we had $15 million this past year, if I remember the numbers, but we had $97 million in requests. So we had to really vet down on what programs were there, trying to incorporate both proven strategies and new entities that are forming. I mean, we have opioid dollars coming into the state. A lot of that is going directly to counties. In Dakota County, they have a robust program that is probably ahead of the curve on a lot of other counties at this point in how they're utilizing those dollars. But number one thing has been harm reduction, getting Narcan available and out in public spaces like you see fire extinguishers, you know, so people have access to that. And that reflects that ability to reduce deaths. And the other one that has been key is, you know, the waivers that have come forth that have worked in other states. There's very few states that have reduced the uptick, a handful only. And a lot of those are either because of the Narcan or because of their waivers that they've had for people coming out of prison who are more susceptible to dying when they return out without proper treatment in prison. And so those are two areas that have been kind of bright spots. What we don't have, though, as acknowledged here, is a lot of education in the schools. There are in Minnesota, I was talking to officers in Hennepin County, and they basically said that there's a lot of schools who don't want to bring this issue into the schools. and they probably do more charter schools than they do public schools. And I think we are, as was mentioned, this is an underutilized pipeline to get information to kids, especially, and utilize education in a way that hasn't been done before in the width and the depth of really making a difference. We're reaching, just with this organization, 110,000 students, but we have 940,000 students in the state of Minnesota. So we need to utilize that in a way where we can get the information out there. Just recently, youth and government was up here at the Capitol. This was their number one issue that they advocated for. They want this information in their schools, and they need to get it. And this was an organization that I learned about in my work, and I thought, this is a proven way to get more out there. And so I think it is in our interest, when we have kids who are needing this, and we're looking at this year at a curriculum reform on health here this year, we should be incorporating this. I have another bill to change verbiage in that curriculum bill that would just add Narcan instruction into that curriculum, because this is an underutilized area. We are building, we're all dealing with mental health, addiction issues, and trying to create the organizations to build that capacity for the growing and increasing need. We have public safety that is involved in this at every level, city, county, state. But education is just a paramount issue that we really do need to focus on and get the information out there in a way that students will accept it and students will use it. And there's not one method to deal with a public health crisis like this, but it is in our interest to use an approach that from a group of organizations like this, nonprofits that can go out and do this work and are doing it well, and we can measure their responses and outcomes. I think this is very important. But to your question, why not other dollars? There are other dollars out there, but if you sit down with your county and you talk about how they're using their dollars in their county, that's kind of a county operation, and they're not doing as much in the schools as they could or should. Future dollars that come in, yes, we have an opportunity with the state funds to, you know, use more of that money for a program like this, but this is something I wanted to do this year because I think there's no reason to wait for it.
Follow up there, Representative Nindle.
Yeah, and thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Bierman. You know, every county dollar goes, at least the programs that I work, goes through an RFP. And, you know, I'm opposed to using general fund dollars for this, and I'm sorry, because until we start honing in on what it is that we're trying to measure, and I agree with you on every single point, but I just think that this organization should compete with the other 50 organizations that are out there that are doing same similar work, trying to reduce opioid use, decrease ED visits, increase recovery, and work with counties. They're the ones that I believe are leading the charge on this. And I had this conversation with Commissioner Cunningham not that long ago about, you know, where is the public health, you know, our Department of Public Health in kind of leading and honing in and providing leadership on this. Right now it's county by county. And I'll stop. I just feel like if money is going to be an issue and we're going to have to decide, you know, where we're going to spend it. And I really think that we should use dedicated opioid funds or settlement dollars for this if we're going to do a thing like this, rather than adding new dollars to the general fund.
Mr. Chair, would
Representative Bierman
committee be willing to hear Ms. Ronnie speak about this, to this issue as well as far as county dollars?
Who? Yes, go ahead. I'm sorry. Yes. Ms. Ronnie, go ahead.
Yeah, I appreciate your question, and it's a really good question. And I can tell you that going down this path was not the first choice. We have tried to pursue county dollars. And so for an 8 or a 10-person organization the size that we are, where 95% of our staff is in classrooms all the time, Every single county in the state of Minnesota has a different approach to how they're using their funding dollars. It is not a coordinated effort. I wish that it was, and I can tell you I started on that road. We have applied for funding in 5 different counties. We've received it in 2, and it's a very arduous process for reporting and issuing invoices and trying to get those dollars back. It is always and consistently has been, education is the smallest bucket of money that is being, you know, utilized by ORAC. We are the only organization in the state of Minnesota that is providing education in schools, that as an outside nonprofit that goes in. We're the only one. And I wish that we could access county dollars. And I have talked to different representatives about how disorganized it is, but I'm not in a position to change that. And I don't think that our kids should pay the price for a disorganized effort on a state level.
Okay. Next, we have Representative Van Binbergen. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Colleen, first of all, I just want to tell you, you know, I'm a dad of 3 kids, and there are 2 of them are in college, and have a lot of discussion with them about this subject. As a dad, you worry about your children, and I just want you to know, I appreciate your testimony, and I can't imagine how difficult it's been, so I want you to know that. A couple of my questions are in regards to your overall budget for your for Change the Outcome. I'm curious what your budget is, how many staff you have. You're in the schools. Can you explain a little bit to me more what that means? You know, how many schools are you getting into in a year? I know I'm asking you a lot of questions here. What grade levels you're focused into. And, you know, I have a little more follow-ups. Maybe you can answer a few of them questions first.
Yeah.
Ms. Ronnie, go ahead.
Thank you. There are 8 of us that work full-time. Megan and I are the old folks on our team. Most of our staff is 25 years or younger, so that they're relatable truth tellers in classrooms. Our annual budget is about $650,000. Most of that is covering things like the traveling to go to any place. I mean, last January we got a call from International Falls, and they were sharing the dilemma that it was a probation officer that reached out and said, we have parents in our community who are encouraging their kids to use substances with them because there's nothing else to do, and they don't want their kids complaining to them about their substance use. So we got on an airplane, and so our budget really covers things like travel, mileage reimbursement, salaries, our insurance, and some basic things like that. So it's about $650,000 annually.
And so how many schools do you get
Representative.
Into? I'm sorry. Excuse me, Mr.
Go ahead. Go ahead, Representative.
How many schools do you get into in a year?
Like this year, we'll be in about 140 middle and high school settings. So about 140 schools total.
Follow up there, Representative.
Sure. So I too have a concern like Representative Nadal about the funding mechanism. And so you're looking at 500,000 in 26 and 500,000 in 27. And then what's your sense of the future past that?
So what
Mrs. Ronnie, go
I'm
ahead.
I'm sorry.
No, that's fine.
We have found that the more schools we get into, the more schools want us to come. So when we're in Aiken County and we go to one school, the surrounding community schools reach out to us and say, can you come please come back? We want you to be in these other schools. We are at capacity. We cannot accept any more commitments or requests from schools this year. We are booked, as Sydney said, every single school day from now until the end of the school year, we're in schools. And so if we're going to meet what we expect to be an ongoing and increasing request for this, for our programming, we need to be able to double our staff.
Okay, because we are getting close to our end here, I'm going to go, we have two more reps on the list, so I'm going to go to Representative Ryer. Go ahead with your question, please. And then we have Representative Liebling, and then we are going to be done at quarter two, folks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you all for coming to present, and Rep. Bierman for bringing this forward. And I want to acknowledge all of you for the effort that it takes to come and testify in a place like this on things that are so personal and matter so much. So thank you all. I more want to make a comment. To me, the value in a program like this is you're going where the kids are. You know, you are doing prevention work. My kids all went to Eastview. I have four adult children. And I'm really putting myself in the shoes of people who have had the child come home and say, I don't want to take an opioid, because then they don't need the Narcan. The preventive work, the Narcan's a blessing. It's a wonderful thing. But making sure that kids don't go down that path for whatever reason, they have the knowledge to be able to move forward in a more healthy way, in a more sustainable way. I did have other questions, but other people have taken care of it, that they were on more of the logistics. So I'm just going to leave it at that, Mr. Chair. Just thank you.
Thank you. Last question, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, same, you know, of course, hearing your story, it's heartbreaking. And it, unfortunately, it's not the first time we heard this story in this legislature. And obviously, we've been grappling with this issue for a while, and we're going to continue to grapple with it. So, you know, no shade at all to the bill that you all have and to Representative Bierman's work on this. He's very knowledgeable. But I do want to just speak to Representative Nadeau. And I don't see, he's not here now. Yes.
He stepped out.
He stepped out. Okay. But, you know, there is a larger issue, I think, about how we're dealing with this issue and all the different pots of funding and how we do this. This is probably absolute heresy, but I really think ORAC is not constitutional. And because ORAC is a subgroup of legislators and non-legislators deciding how to spend money, which I really have a problem with that. But we do have, in MMB, we have a special position to coordinate response to addiction issues. And we have Jeremy Drucker, who, and I don't know what his title is. Maybe you probably do, but he's kind of supposed to be helping, and I'm sure he is. He's pretty new in the job. And I just kind of wanted to flag that and just to sort of support Representative Nadeau's, I think, larger question. Again, with no shade to what you all are trying to do at all, but just to say, I think it's absolutely true. We need to coordinate this better and have a better kind of big picture sense of, you know, how much are we doing in the prevention space? How much are we doing in the treatment space? And kind of so that we make sure that we are appropriately, or at least we make a decision about how much we want to put toward different aspects of this problem and make sure that we are using the money in the best, to get the best possible results for everybody. I think it's a very good point. So thank you for bringing the bill, Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Chair, could we have just one more comment, please?
I'll use your, go ahead, one more comment, because we got 2 minutes left. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Backer. I just want to say, as an educator, as a mom of an Eastview kiddo, I understand the concerns. I also, what I'm hearing is, let's pause what we're doing right now to think about, I think about the old adage of, you know, instead of putting a fence at the top of the cliff, we're putting an ambulance at the bottom. And what we're doing is we're putting the fence up top. We're having these conversations with kids every day. And what we tell the students is, We know statistically most of you are not going on to develop a substance use disorder, but statistically we know that you love somebody who has a substance use disorder, and we want to prevent and create space, prevent more overdoses and create spaces where people feel safe, where they can utilize Narcan treatment, those other pieces, right? But we want to inform students so that they don't travel down that path, and that's just not happening. I'll give one other example. We can talk about the reforms that are helping or starting to happen in the Health Standards Committee. I was with a health teacher last week who said, in my school district, we get 8 days all year of health, and I devote 2 of those days to your program because I know how important it is. And so until we have a standardized health curriculum that can't keep up with the data and what's happening with the opioid epidemic, programs like ours are saving lives. And we're doing everything we can to get dollars wherever we can, and we hope that you guys will support this bill so we can continue to do the good work.
Okay, Representative Bierman, 30 seconds to close. 30 seconds.
Mr. Chair, she was my closer. Thank you.
Okay, well, that's good. I appreciate that. So, and thank you. We do appreciate you all coming in. We know this is an important issue. So thank you, Representative Bierman. The chair lays over House File 981 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill or further consideration at a later date. Seeing no further business before the committee, our next hearing is Monday, March 3rd. We are adjourned. Thank you, members.